Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. I've been invited to offer a few words for your reflection this evening. I've just been on a retreat over in the retreat centre, a 10-day retreat. And a long time since I stayed over there, quite a few years. And my first retreat there as a layman was in 1992. Which seems quite a long time ago. That was in the summer months as well. So over these 10 days there's been quite a few memories arising from this previous retreat, things that I hadn't remembered before, but also things that I remembered very well and actually stuck in my memory, things that I've repeated quite often. So I thought I'd say a few words about this. It's interesting, isn't it, when you can re-encounter your past, but particularly in practice terms, you see the difference between your mind then and your mind now in a kind of controlled situation. It's like a kind of laboratory, isn't it? You know, same room, same cushion, like a laboratory experiment, isn't it? Something like that. So it's quite revealing. There's one story that I've told many times actually about this retreat centre and that particular retreat, where a teacher was encouraging us to develop mindfulness, and he said that one way of doing this, one example would be, say, to be very aware of opening but also closing a door. So this is a good example of mindfulness. You're aware of something right the way through from the beginning to the end. So there's a door here that I went through every time I went out to walking meditation from sitting meditation. I would open and mindfully close this door. It wasn't a swing door, it's a swing door now. It wasn't a swing door in those days. You closed it with the handle. So there's this kind of click. A little click as you pull it to. So I did this out of faith at this month's retreat. Didn't think anything of it at all at the time. It's just part of the whole thing. And I came back to the retreat centre about 6 months later. I came back to the monastery, stayed in the monastery. When I walked round the corner here and saw the door for the first time, I had this leap of joy. It came completely by surprise, totally by surprise. Nothing special at the time, and in a way, that nothing really special about that either. Just the surprise of it, coming out of nowhere like that. Intriguing. Very intriguing. I look back on this and with great affection. Such affection for that door. It's given me affection for that door. Funny thing, isn't it, having an affection for a door? It's not really a normal kind of affection. It's a different kind of affection, perhaps. It's not come through enjoying anything. Not that I enjoyed this process. There's nothing that I enjoyed about it. It was a completely neutral experience. But something recognised, perhaps, the peace of this experience. And seeing that door again and return to the peace that I didn't realise I'd had, something like that. See it again. This is how natural the practice can be, just this simple act of paying attention to the most ordinary thing and make it into a kind of extraordinary thing. Becomes a kind of teacher. Sometimes we can see this in a different way when we just sit and we examine something. If we do this for long enough, you know, we sit and maybe look at some object here, quite a neutral object is a good one, just stare at it until you lose interest in it. Stare at something, the incense bowl or something, keep staring at it. You know, stare at it long enough and it's like it starts to kind of ask questions of us in some way. Something like that, seems like that to me anyway. You know, why are you staring at me for? Something. This is the beginning of the taste of mindfulness. And we've just been chanting the Anattalakkhana Sutta, a discourse on not-self, you know, saying, oh, you know, you realise that you can't make your feelings what you'd like them to be. You know, you can't, may my feelings be thus, and they will be thus. Let my perceptions be thus, and they will be thus. You can't do that. You know, you can't just get a hold of your mind, and as much as we'd like to sometimes, we'd like to get a hold of it and, sometimes and raise it up or throttle it. Can't really do that. Can't really make it what we want like that. This is the way then that the practice bears fruit, like this, in this natural way. You know, we apply ourselves through faith, and then it's as though the results of our practice come back to us out of things. Various ways. I mean, plant the seeds and the results come back to us in various ways. It's often mysterious and a lovely process. I was remembering as well, I took the same walking path just out the back here that I was on in 1992. I remember wondering, what is walking meditation and what is this one about? You know, I can understand, you know, sitting there and getting peaceful, you know, it's nice. Oh, yeah, it's like, yeah. Although I'll come on to the sitting part in a minute. I mean, that wasn't so easy actually at that time. But the walking meditation, there's the walking up and down. What's all this one about? Surprises there as well. Quite recently I was in Thailand and I was asked to give a talk, and I thought, what's the question that I'm asked most of all in Thailand? Why did you become a Buddhist? And why did you convert to Buddhism? It's a question you always get asked in Thailand. I would want to know. I'm quite proud of the fact that he was a convert from Christianity or whatever. Why did you convert to Buddhism, they say, all proud. And, of course, you know, many times I've given the answer, my brother met Lumpu Samedo on a train, you know, which is kind of, was kind of the beginning of it many years ago. And I started coming here in the early days, listening to Lumpu Samedo's talks. But this day, I just different answer popped into mind. I said, well, it's kind of because of rubber bands, really. I ended up giving this talk in a monastery in Thailand, trying to explain to these Thai people what I meant. Why did I convert to Buddhism over rubber bands? But this is another example. After this retreat, I went back to my daily life, And it's a really tough time, the worst year in my life, actually. So my father died very suddenly, about 6 weeks before my final exams at college. Living in London, trying to revise for my exams, I was stressed out. The way I'd de-stress myself is I'd go for walks. One day I was sort of walking along the road and I noticed these rubber bands on the pavement. So the postman, when he puts the post through the box, then he was just throwing the rubber bands on the ground. So these rubber bands on the pavement. So my stress state, I was looking at these rubber bands. Oh, these are very quite nice rubber bands. That seems a bit of a waste, all these rubber bands sitting on the pavement. So I started collecting the rubber bands. And walking around, I mean, I look back on it now, I think, oh, people must have thought I was crazy. Imagine this guy walking around picking up rubber bands off the street. But I found myself becoming very peaceful, just picking up these rubber bands. Again, a kind of strange one. But what I realised was, I look back on this later, what I realised was that looking down, walking around, and looking down at the ground rather than looking up at everything, which is what I've been doing on my walking path. Yeah, I've been doing this on my walking path. Calmed the mind. Very simple, isn't it? Totally simple. And yet at that really stressful time to take a walk and to find myself doing this, you know, without trying to get anything, trying to get anywhere or do anything with my mind, I found myself becoming very peaceful, like a return to this state, a meditation state, a subtle return to this meditation state. So I can look back on that and I can really now understand, you know, why walk up and down? You know, when it's a nice day and you can think, well, I could be doing something else. Could be on the beach even. It's been lovely weather, isn't it? So I'm walking up and down. But now I can see it like an investment. The times when it saved me, you know, walking up and down and really angry about something or something. Just start walking up and down, pacing up and down. All of a sudden, something happens. Again, quite unexpected. Yet there's this kind of subtle return to this state of meditation. I was noticing this today, how after the retreat, so getting up, I was just doing a lot of sitting meditation, then starting to talk again and walk about the monastery and everything, and just coming to simply sit down and cross my legs, you know, how all of a sudden the mind just went quiet. Suddenly all stirred up and walking around the monastery, lots of people around and people asking me questions and so on, a change of gear, and yet just sitting down, crossing the legs immediately, this kind of subtle effect, or just walking into the sala here, this kind of mood arising, and then just watching it, yip, like that, yip. You do that. You watch them. You see them go right to the end. There's always this little zip. If you ever noticed, and it's gone. Lovely. You know, seen the end of it. Something in me hadn't followed it. You know, was still from the practice. There's still a stillness there. And all this movement and zip. Gone. See the end of it. Realize it hasn't gone anywhere. You know, it's just gone. Disappeared. Boop. We can already be thinking, or otherwise we can be thinking, oh, well, these moods, you know, they keep coming and going. They must be coming from somewhere, you know. Up they come, down they go. Up they come, down they go. They're down there waiting for me. I know they are. Kind of feeling. is kind of assumed until you see something like that. You know, it breaks that one. You see something end. Yep. We have all these assumptions in our minds about the nature of our experience, and these actually can form our experience. We end up afraid of our own minds in this sense of these dark forces waiting. Something like that. For that, that moment, that kind of way of seeing is broken through. You're not coming up with another theory. You're not going to go and knock on. You're not going to try and dig up Freud and tell him he was wrong or anything and say, "You've got it all wrong." It's not like that. It's not that you come up with another theory. You want to bang the table, but you've just seen it a different way. This is the way it can work. Seeing things in a different way, and seeing it, not thinking it or analysing it. So we can make a lot of assumptions about the words that we see in the suttas. Again, from the Anattalakkhana Sutta this evening, this word nibbida, disenchantment at the end. Our mind becomes disenchanted with feeling and disenchanted with perception and disenchanted with mental formation. Sounds awful, doesn't it? It's a real downer. I'm so disenchanted with my mental formations and they're such a drag. Sounds like that, doesn't it? But maybe it's not like that. It's a different experience. If there's a letting go, then there's a different experience. A mysterious one. They're talking about this door, the closing of the door. It wasn't analysing, it was just being mindful. Mindfulness itself had a message, didn't it? Had its own message. See the arising and ceasing of a phenomenon. Something then is drawn to that, is drawn to the peace of that. And because it's nothing to do with this, with the normal functioning of the mind, then it's kind of a mysterious thing, surprising thing, or a beautiful thing. It's a different kind of beauty, isn't it? This kind of a different kind of enjoyment. It's not that the mind's going out into things. This is what we can see. Another thing we can see very clearly through doing meditation practice and concentration practice. If we bring our mind, so we spend a couple of hours at the nose tip, sit there, in, out, it's gathering the mind to this point. So in worldly terms, it's not really anywhere. In personal terms, it's not anywhere. We're not in the world, and we're not here, we're not in the body, we're not in our feelings either. It's this kind of gap in the middle, in the middle of nowhere, kind of thing, nose tip. Gathering this mind, this kind of space in the middle of between two worlds in some ways, where I can see that. And stilling the mind, mind goes still, calms down, goes still. And you get up from your sitting cushion, go out to do walking meditation, something catches your eye, you can see your mind going out through the eye and thum, out it goes. You see the movement, begin to see the movements of the mind. And we see how our minds go out and grasp things or go out and play with things. And we can see see what that's like. It can be very pleasant. Nice day. Maybe we shouldn't, not a but, but a and. So we, it can be very pleasant, and then at the end of it, you know, we go out in a nice day, go out into the nice breezy field, come back into the shrine room here. Immediately there can be a kind of, I'd rather be out there in the breezy field. So what's happened? You know, there's a movement out of the mind, you know, a grasping of experience. It's movement out to liking and disliking. Whereas there's another way of experiencing, isn't there? Things just come to us, just like this experience with the door, something just comes to you. Something like that, or just the grass. You know, you'll be walking out there and your mind doesn't go out to the grass comes to you, doesn't it? You know, or the beautiful flowers, you know, go running after the roses come to you. They're not going anywhere, are they? They're stuck in the ground. You don't go out there and grasp at them, they come to you. That's a different experience. So you see the difference between these two. You have to try to persuade you of anything. You know, discover these things for yourself. You know, this is all things that we discover for ourselves, isn't it? Really seeing how the mind works, beginning to understand, see for ourselves how the mind works. It's just seeing its movements and the relationship between movement and stillness, stilling the mind. Then this reveals the movement. If we have a still field, you know, a calm mind, then this reveals all the movements, doesn't it? You know, maybe we've never seen before when we've been moving around with things. As soon as the mind becomes still, then all these movements are obvious to see. This kind of thing. So we don't need anyone to tell us about what's going on. We can watch these things. This is very important, isn't it? We don't have any doubt about it all. We find ways of working with it all, which are not trying to make our feelings the way we would like them, you know, not just let my feelings be thus, let my perceptions be thus, but we find skillful means, ways of working with things, watching for ourselves with an open mind, examining for ourselves. This is a relationship between what we would call samatha and vipassana, isn't it? Samatha, the stillness of the mind. And then vipassana, clear seeing. So it's a clear seeing, both of these movements of the mind, but of everything else, actually. The calm mind sees the nature of things. So it's the kind of nature of things that we can become interested in rather than the particulars of things. You see what their nature is, underlying nature. There can be all kinds of strands to this practice as well, can't there? It's not just the sitting practice, but there's all kinds of things we can be doing as well. I've so far talked about kind of not doing or not doing, how we can learn through this difference between doing and not doing, something like that. But there's also a lot of things we can do. If we're committed to our practice, we can study, for example, or study Pali, do all kinds of things which at the beginning, just the same as walking up and down, you wonder, oh, why am I doing this, studying Pali or whatever it is. Maybe that's more obvious to some people, making an investment in study or another area of practice. You have faith in that. You know, I know something, you know, I've learnt something. But we have to understand this, understand the way this works as well, how we're again with planting seeds. We're not to understand from the book is not to understand in the way of the Buddha. We're planting seeds. We're thinking in a certain way about things, and that those thoughts can come back to us, just the same as this practice of opening and closing the door can come back to us. These thoughts can come back to us out of nowhere. And when the mind's calm, it's like that, comes back to us out of nowhere, out of the silence Lompo Sumedho was talking about. Insight coming out of the silence, out of the stillness. So this is how the fruits can come. This is when they really have an effect on the heart. So it's quite a clear understanding of this in Thai culture, this difference between Pariyatti Dham and Patipat Dham, which is the knowledge of study and the knowledge of practice. They're clearly seen as of a different order. It can be very useful to think in a clear way, and yet there's a need for this to go deeper into the heart in order to get to the root of craving. We're still thinking, we're still studying, we're still in a superficial level, say. And we need to be able to draw these things deeply into ourselves in some way. Or rather, we need to allow this to happen. You know, we plant the seeds, thinking in certain ways, perceiving things in certain ways, learning to see things differently, or looking at particular things, recommended things, recommended objects of contemplation, and then allowing this to work on us, or just planting the seed and then letting the result come to us when it comes, when you're ready. It's when the karma turning the karma around, isn't it? You know, we've been making a lot of karma in the worldly direction all our lives, and as practitioners, then we can make a lot of karma in the unworldly direction, or opposite direction, direction of relinquishment and virtue. And then this comes back to us, and naturally comes back to us. Yet there's always this leap of faith that we have to put out the effort and then just have faith that the fruits will come. Or it can be like driving a car, as I use that example sometimes. But, you know, if you were going to learn to drive a car, how if you went to learn to drive a car, and at the beginning you just were given this wheel and you had to learn how to go like this with it. Stage one, you get this wheel and go like that. You'd feel meaningless, wouldn't it? What am I doing this for? A waste of time. You're just given a little mirror. You know, you have to learn to look in this mirror or something. All these different elements of driving, aren't they? You pull it all apart and it can all seem completely meaningless. In some ways, if you pull the practice apart into all its different elements, and walking, sitting, walking up and down, studying, times when it can seem meaningless, it just in and of itself. And yet, these skills all can fall together, can't they? And finally get in the car, and you know where the brake is and where the clutch is and the steering wheel, and you actually find this thing moving. It can be an exhilarating experience. You realise you've got control over something, or or you've got you can take this thing places. Yeah. Exhilarating. The whole thing can kind of fall together. Different elements of the practice can fall together, come together, come back to us into this kind of space, still space, something like this. So in this way we can, this is the way we can use a shrine, these objects on the shrine, objects for our contemplation, we're making skillful karma, contemplating all these things, giving them importance, raising up the wholesome things. And over time this good karma comes back to us. If we're having a hard time, we can come in here, bow to the shrine, and the shrine is a kind of refuge to us, isn't it? Or the skeleton in the back. Somebody, a friend of my mother's here this evening, incidentally, back here. It's kind of nice. She brought a friend of hers who had not a lot of experience in Buddhism at all into the temple today. It was nice to see. She walked in, first reaction, just looked at her. Whoa! Nice, isn't it? It's beautiful, isn't it? And then I took her around and showed her this chapel behind with a reclining Buddha and this skeleton hanging at the end. And afterwards, she asking my mother, what's the skeleton all about? Why a skeleton? It's a hard one, that one. It's a hard one to explain. It's a traditional thing in the forest monastery. In Thailand, all the little forest monasteries, Wat Pho Phong, Ajahn Chah, monasteries in this tradition in Thailand, you always see a skeleton. And usually right next to the shrine, so you can't miss it. You have the Buddha, and then you have the skeleton. Later on today, I was thinking, what could I have said to my mother's friend? Just a few minutes. And I thought, there you are, you have the sign of time and the sign of timelessness next to each other, quite graphically, isn't it? We have the Buddha representing a timeless, ineffable reality. Next to it, you have this sign of time, a skeleton. You put them next to each other, and then you got the whole thing. You come in here and you're all inspired, like she was. Walks in, she's all inspired by the lovely space and the Buddha Rupa. And she walks behind there and sees the skeleton. She's got the two things at different times, isn't she? So she's, this is lovely, but what on earth's that doing here? if you have the two, you try and look at the two together. The two together, it's a different effect somehow. You've got the two together there in the visual field in this case, and your heart can kind of make its choice. Where does your heart gravitate towards? What does it gravitate towards? In that case, look at the skeleton. Look at the Buddha Rupa. Obvious, isn't it? We put the two things together, and there's quite a strong effect, isn't there? And this is actually what in meditation, in the Thai forest tradition, this is what we're aiming at. We're sitting here and we're looking at our own bodies. Sat there and breathing in and out. The breath is a kind of a bridge between the mind and the body. In this respect, so there you are, you sat there, you've got your body sitting there, haven't you? Breathing in and out. You're putting the mind into the breath, and then the breath comes into the body. So you're kind of drawing the mind into the body, aren't you, is one way of looking at it. And, you're you're becoming more aware of the body within this spacious mind or calm, still mind. Or you can end up with this same thing inside, this same juxtaposition of the two things, the mind, the pure mind, the still mind, and the body. And these two things together, this is where, in Thai forest tradition, this is where the deep practice is. This is where they're always trying to get you to go at some point or another. So often they want you to develop your concentration, mindfulness, concentration, and a sense of confidence and well-being, a sense of the stability of the mind. But then they'll always challenge you, the great Ajahns will always challenge you, Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Mun up here, they would always challenge you to then examine the body. People would be surprised by this, particularly if they develop good samadhi, it's a wonderful state, empty, bright, beautiful state. Here I am in this beautiful state, and why does Longpo Cha want me to contemplate the body, this coarse thing? Why would he want me to do that? It's like, surely this is kind of going from the eternal from the timeless to time, perhaps. Resistance in the mind. And yet there can be a tremendous coolness that can be drawn into the mind from this practice. Steadiness, firming up of the samadhi. So to the way that the great masters always would point out, the way Lumpur Sumedho does, with the temporary nature of the concentration, results of concentration. This is a fragile thing, this peace that we can develop. We've seen this earlier today coming out of retreat, just how fragile this sense of peace can be. This is very important. But the great Ajahns have pointed out to us that there is a way in which we can steady this state. State's not a very good word. And this just is through a natural awareness of the body as well. It's not that we have to face death straight away. But this is what we are facing when we do this, isn't it? To develop just a natural awareness of the body as it takes us in this direction. Sitting, being aware of the posture, and walking, being aware of the posture and movements of the body. Different from our usual way priority. Often we're aware of the body because of feeling. A feeling is what we're looking for, pleasant feeling. So we're attending to the body in a particular way so as to develop this perception of the body rather than a heightened awareness of feeling. This is a different thing. This is the first and the second foundations of mindfulness, isn't it? And the difference between these two. The first one, being aware of what you're doing, walking up and down or doing whatever you're doing, physical movement, very simple elements, the weight of the body, heat of the body, the way it's, you feel the elements of the body, the elements outside, and it's nice. Hot weather, it's a warm breeze, the breath, the warm breath, the warm breeze, kind of elemental appreciation of the body, which is a kind of just like a receiving of the body. It's not, right, so I remember Lompo Smeda always used to say it's like the body in the mind rather than the mind in the body. And this kind of thing, it's a kind of different appreciation. It's like I was saying about going outside and appreciating a nice day. You're just letting it come to you. This kind of thing. This is how we can develop quite naturally an awareness of the body, a heightened awareness of the body, in a very positive way. So it doesn't have to be initially, or it doesn't ever have to be actually a negative thing. If it becomes a negative thing, actually our mind's gone too far. Not that we can't pull it back, we can rebalance our mind. I was watching, someone showed me a video once of this man who'd learnt Tai Chi years ago in the 1970s, where it was quite rare in England, with a Norwegian lady called Gerda Geddes. A lot of her pupils were dancers and people like that. So they were wanting to free up their movement. Doing Tai Chi, so they didn't have a spiritual purpose so much. This interview with this man, a video, this man was talking about his experience and saying, oh yes, when I do these movements, then I can feel my body so clearly, and I actually can see into my hand. It's absolutely marvellous, fascinating. I can just move in my hand like that, I can just see the bones in there. I was thinking, gosh, this man's having an experience that a lot of Thai monks I know would absolutely die for. Subhanimitta, they would call it. This vision, this seeing into the body. And to see inside the body. And it's just full of curiosity, interest, lightness. So people read about this practice, they can get put off. It's a funny thing, isn't it? Satipatthana Sutta is probably the most important of any in Buddhist world, isn't it? The Four Foundations of Mindfulness. You get to page 3 and you're on the decaying bodies. How far do you get? You can we get any further. The Buddha recommends, you start off with walking up and down and the elements, and then you contemplate a body in the cemetery and the body decaying. How far do you get if you just pick up the book? Not very appealing, is it? And yet you can, if you approach this in a very natural way, then there is no fear to it or aversion to it. And it can lead to letting go, a very deep letting go. Lack of concern. So many of our concerns come out of attachment to the body, don't they? A worry about... bodies are a worry, aren't they? Maybe we don't realise this. A comfortable society, we're all living nice, comfortable lives, and we don't think like this. We don't see you have a very positive view of the body, and yet sometimes in Thailand, I've been in a situation, you're in a monastery where you're not very well, you can't speak the language. There's no medicine in the monastery, you're in a situation where you can't just switch on a fan, or you've got no mosquito repellent, or this kind of thing. And to realise, wait a minute, you kind of recommend these things to people, these kinds of experiences, missing a night's sleep or a meal. Kinds of things. This doesn't have to threaten our other perceptions of the body either. It's as a, you know, like a doctor learns a particular perception of the body for a particular purpose, doesn't he? You know, he doesn't always see bodies like he does when he's at work. You know, he sticks on his doctor's spectacles, doesn't he? And looks in a particular way with a particular purpose. And as practitioners, we can do the same thing. We can do this with anything. We can put on our contemplative eyes, so to speak. A different purpose, don't we? The purpose of freedom from concern. It's kind of the way in which is another way you can talk about this is the body not being self. Again, going back to this sutta that we were chanting earlier. The body is not self. And we can see this in many ways. Walking up and down, even, you know, as walking through the field the other day, been walking meditation, I kind of got my mind in this direction, and then I saw this little girl. There's this little girl walking out, a cute little Sri Lankan girl walking out into the field. And she's still at this age where she didn't really know how her body worked. You know, little kids, you know, they don't really know, do they? You know, she's walking out, their arms and legs everywhere. It kind of works, you know, the head still floats along there, but I haven't really got the hang of it yet, you know. I've been up and walking around thinking, gosh, you know, I'm not sure I've got the hang of it yet. You know, here I am, I'm 48 years old. You know, and I just discovered, oh, if I just do this stretch at my hip, you know, oh, it's so much, you know, I can stand up straighter and, oh, how nice, you know. I'm still learning how to use mine. You know, learning about the mind, you know, you learn how to use your mind, you know. Have what to do with it, how it works. It's odd, isn't it? You know, you think it's you. You know, why do we have to learn how to use it, or how it works? We know, wouldn't we? And yet, you know, these situations, you think, oh, it's funny, isn't it? You know, maybe didn't really know. So I'm discovering new things about this thing that I'm walking around in. This is amazing. It's got this kind of taste of anatta, isn't it? This taste of not self, it's a taint of it. It's your taint of it. It's not the big one. I mean, these realization of not self is a huge thing. So not to underplay this one. You know, it's a radical, very radical experience. It can take a lot of courage and radical practice. My teacher in Thailand, Ajahn Adnan, he became so adept. He could contemplate the body. And one day he sitting there, meditating in a very peaceful state, and he imagined taking all the skin off the body. He took all the skin off his body and held it out like this and dropped it. And there's this picture, I saw this picture the other day from this strange exhibition. I don't know if anyone's seen the Body Worlds exhibition. This man's made these, rather an odd thing actually, I'm not sure how I feel about it. He's actually made real bodies into plastic models, and impregnated them with plastic. And there's one of this man who's holding his skin out like this in his hand. My teacher Ajahn Anand could do this in his mind. He imagined himself doing this. He had taken all the skin off his body, held it up with his hand like that, dropped it, boom. And then, boom. And his mind went very deep, very deep. You're seeing that not self, this is an impermanent, not self nature of the body. So just prior to that, actually, a very moving story. He was telling it on one anniversary of the monastery. He was telling the story, the practice that led up to that. He was saying he was sitting on a platform in the middle of the jungle, malaria, right, sick, hungry, tired monk. Yes. He'd been teaching himself, you know, contemplating the body in this way, this kind of automatic way, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin. Tacholo ma naka danta. Like this over and over. You see him again, it's completely mechanical, become completely mechanical. This is in the ordination, incidentally. This is for monk's ordination. This contemplation, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin. Sitting there over and over, hair of the bed, hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin, head to the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin. And then he said his mind just kind of shifted a bit. And then he was saying, oh, he was feeling so sick. And so and he just said, oh, well, it's just hair of the head, hair of the body. Nails, teeth and skin, like that. This kind of subtle shift, you know, nothing like you, kind of, oh, nothing, no aversion, just a kind of letting go, subtle letting go. Oh, it's just the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin. Anyway, this is a subtle thing, and yet that was a very powerful karma, renunciant karma he was making. Now, you know, you go to his monastery now, and he's meet Ajahn Anand, and he's a permanently happy man. No worries, no desires, no worries. Never seen a trace of anger. Never seen him want anything. Bright, happy, it's like Tigger, Winnie the Pooh. Bouncing around, no worries. Let go of the body, you know, light as a feather, absolutely light as a feather. So this is possible, you know, this heavy body, you know, not to go so far as to be averse to it or irritated by it, but there's weight to it, doesn't it? And you know, you're walking around, weight to it. So you can actually overcome this. You know, mind can actually overcome this weight. Extraordinary, isn't it? You know, these things that you think are fixed, fixed things. You know, the fixed perception of the body or the fixed experience of it. See, the body is an incredibly fixed thing, isn't it? Of all the things that we take to be ourselves. Feeling and perception and thought and all the rest of it, the khandhas. And the body is the most solid. Okay, you think, oh well, you know, how am I going to change this one? So I remember in my early years as a monk, sometimes you know, get into lovely states of mind where everything, nothing looked real anymore. You know, you've been walking around, oh, it's lovely, it's just like a dream, you know, fantastic. And inevitably, it seemed with me, along come the body, you know, trancing along, going along there very nicely, and then, pop. And it's happened to me very strongly at Chittas Monastery. And had a very good retreat in the forest, but unknown to me, you know, all the hard work that I'd been doing, there was just this time bomb waiting in my back, you know. Came out of my retreat, bent over in the shower, thum. I was on my back for 6 weeks in agony. Oops. Along comes the body. What? It seemed quite stark, you know, trancing along, and then all of a sudden, Back to reality, it could seem like that. And yet there's scope even here to change experience. So if we're bringing the mind and the body together, this is the way that we see that the two are different things. We see them as different things. Okay, and the stillness of the mind, it reveals the movement of the body, this kind of thing. Yeah, so sitting this evening, so we have an evening sitting this evening, and we're encouraged to sit and meditate. We have this opportunity of supporting each other, sitting together, sitting here still. It's a sense of spiritual camaraderie. Here we are all together. Experienced people and people who are new to everything. This is how we can, we can gather ourselves together, and we can gather together and find the strength to walk this kind of path, and the courage in a group, can't we? We can investigate together these kinds of things. And without fear, we have no fear over it. Talking about tried and tested, things that are tried and tested over 2,500 years. This is not a new idea, not really an idea, is it? I'm talking about ideas, I'm talking about a way of experiencing things, a way of revealing the nature of experience that's been tried and tested over 2,500 years of history. We can draw confidence and faith, you'd have no fear. You see Ajahn Mun and Ajahn Chah here. Ajahn Mun, a figure of tremendous faith in Thailand. Before Ajahn Mun, Buddhism was going a bit off in Thailand. Ajahn Mun came along, and he was pressured actually at a time when people were losing faith in the forest tradition in Thailand. Ajahn Mun was pressured to identify realized monks. It's not something you normally do. So identified a number of realized monks, and all these monks lived out their lives impeccably. Were wonderful monks. You see how few people actually make it through to die in the robe. Then the chances of Ajahn Mun being of these people being how to put this, you know what I mean. A lot of faith arose out of that. It's a tradition that we can have a lot of faith in. There's no doubts about it. It's just a matter of, you see how people sometimes they can underestimate how far the practice can go. The practice goes a long way, radical thing. Goes a long way. It can take a long time, it can be a long path. So what we need is a long term view, a kind of patience and humility. Start from where we are. Just with these simple things. I was saying earlier, me in 1992, open and closing the door, I didn't know where it was going. Did I? I didn't know what I was letting myself in for. At all. Simple things. Deceptive, isn't it? Maybe there was whole new doors going to open out of that. Completely new. New perceptions. New experiences. Fresh. Things coming to us from nowhere. This kind of extraordinary, ordinary, the ordinary, extraordinary. There's this ordinariness, ordinary existence. Rubber bands or doors. So, I guess it's enough for one evening. Just encourage everyone to keep going until midnight this evening, if people feel able.
Annamayam dhammakathaya sadukaram dadhamase.